It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Supreme Court made a pair of rulings on religion and public schools over the last week. We examine the current state of the separation of church and state. First, it's National Migraine and Headache Awareness Month. Migraine is a very common disorder. It affects an estimated 12% of Americans, with women about three times as likely to be affected as men. That's according to the Cleveland Clinic. When you think of a migraine, you might think of a visual aura followed by a debilitating headache. That's what migraine looks like for some people, but it's not always the case. Symptoms can vary a lot from person to person. And from migraine to migraine, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get migraines? When did you start getting them? What have you learned about them and maybe what seems to trigger them in your life? Do you have questions for our guest about migraines, what they are, how they're treated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Ala Abed El Sayed, or Dr. Al, is the medical director of UW Health Pain Services and medical director of the UW Pain Clinic, where he performs migraine pain interventions. Dr. Al, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I have in my head, I probably like a lot of people, this conception that, you know, you get the visuals of a migraine, then you get the big headache of the migraine. But it, like I just said, it doesn't always work that way. Can you talk about the range of things people might experience with a migraine?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing this point, because it's a very important point. Sometimes we learn about the, I would say, the classic picture of migraine coming with aura and all those symptoms. But actually, most of the time in my practice, I'll see a patient without an aura. That's why I recommend that anyone who's having headaches that are of nature concerning, they need to be checked, because it could be migraine. It doesn't have to be accompanied by the aura.
Yeah, for people like I sometimes get headaches. I think pretty much everybody gets a headache now and then. I'm pretty sure I've never had a migraine, but I guess I don't know for sure. When do I say, hey, maybe this is more than just your run-of-the-mill headache, and get, evaluated for migraines?
So there are very well kind of published diagnostic criteria. I'll go through it in 1 minute here.
Sure.
But if patients have five attacks, with headaches lasting 4 to 72 hours, which can be unilateral in nature, pulsating quality, moderate to severe pain, causing impairment of routine physical activity, associated with nausea, vomiting, sensitivity to light. All of these are criteria that can warn the patient that this could be a migraine headache.
And you said unilateral, meaning on one side of the face or one side of the head?
And this is the typical picture. There are, sometimes I'll see bilateral, I'll say much less frequent. But typically in the diagnostic criteria, if it's taking one side of the head, unilateral.
Now, suppose somebody is diagnosed with migraines. Is there much we can do about them? Do we have effective treatments that are going to help a lot of people?
There are treatments, and the first thing in treatment is to trying to identify triggers. So usually we'll ask patients if what triggers your headache. Sometimes it can be eating chocolate, alcohol, drinking alcohol, stressors, sleep change, certain physical factors. And we try to eliminate those triggers first. And then we try to educate the patient on meditation, some behavioral changes. If that doesn't get us all the way to control the headaches, then we start talking about the two classes of medications, either medications to treat the headache as they occur, and there are medications that prevent them from happening. So if the headache can happen, people can use over-the-counter medication, what's called the triptans, DHE. These are medications to abort the headaches when they happen. Preventive medication, things like using blood pressure medication, antidepressants, anti-seizure medications, which are taken on a regular basis to reduce kind of the occurrence of migraines. So there are good treatments. Mm. And then we have the interventional treatment as well. If medication treatments are not providing satisfactory control, then we use interventions.
Now, before we get into some of those interventions, I should ask, I'm curious, if you could put it in terms that even I can understand, what's going on in our head when we get a migraine? Physically, what is causing it?
Another good question, and I'll keep it very simple.
Thank you.
Basically, triggers or something will cause, stimulation of brain cells. This increases some chemical mediators in the body. That's why we talk about the aura prodrome and many other symptoms, because there is increasing chemical transmitters that can cause many body symptoms. In turn, those chemical mediators can cause vasoconstriction, which causes the headaches. Similar effect happens with estrogen. That's why We find it more common in women because they have more estrogen. So that's all why, it's more of a systemic, I would say, condition more than a headache in itself.
We're talking about migraines with Dr. Ala Abdel-Sayed, a.k.a. Dr. Al from UW Health and the UW Pain Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to share your experiences with migraines. Were you able to find something that seemed to trigger them? Did it help to avoid it? Is there something that has worked for you? Do you have a question about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jade joins us now in Manitouish Waters. Jade, hi.
Hi there. How you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Jade?
I identify with a lot of what he was saying. My mother started having migraines when I was 5. I'm 27 now, and it started with auras on some days, then most days, then pain was introduced, and now it's been about 10 years where it's just been nonstop pain for her. And she, like you said, Botox worked for a while. She had some surgery. She had the hysterectomy to help with the estrogen. They've just done everything, and she just can't find any relief, and it's about pain management at this point for her. And I was wondering how, if you have anything that maybe I haven't really heard before, for management or treatments.
Jade, I'm so sorry for your mom. Best to her, and thanks for sharing her story. Dr. Al, of course, you can't diagnose her over the phone, but for people who, all the treatments might help a little, like Jade was saying, but ultimately it gets worse and worse. What are some of the things that we have now or maybe on the horizon that can help in those cases?
Yeah, I would like to thank you, Jade, for calling and making this, comment, and sorry to hear about your mom and all what she's gone through. And I think that the thing I want to shed some light on here, you can see how dramatic it can go. People can go for surgeries. Migraine can be a life-destroying condition. But before all of this, there are new interventions we do at UW to help with migraines. One of the procedures I described in 2015, which I named the ablation technique, where we do the nerve blocks and what's called radiofrequency ablation, trying to ablate the nerves that can sensitize it when they trigger migraine. So this way we avoid the triggers. Then we use infusion therapies and other things, trying to get people, and we use implantable devices. So try to basically control the migraine so patients do not have to go down the route of having very aggressive surgeries or major surgeries for the treatment of migraine.
Jade, thanks so much for calling. Best again to your mom. We'll go now to Rebecca in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a migraine sufferer for probably the last 25 years, I would say. I had a few of the migraine episodes when I was younger in my 20s with the aura and the flashing lights. But since I had children in my early 30s, I get a migraine probably every time I have my monthly cycle, and I'll get a 2 or 3 or 4, sometimes 5 day migraine. I do have medication I take for it, but now I'm entering perimenopause, and I've noticed that they've gotten way worse than they used to be. I'm getting them sometimes 2-3 times a month, and I'm wondering if that's that estrogen connection that you talked about, and is it low estrogen causing them, too much estrogen causing them? I just notice it's always around the time of my cycle. So I'm just curious about that.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Dr. Al?
Yeah, thank you, Rebecca. Actually, what you mentioned is very classic because it's migraines can be associated with increased estrogen. That's why they can happen around the menstrual cycle every month for women. So pretty typical, and I think, many patients will come explaining that it happens around the menstrual cycle. So again, very standard, and we recommend the patients use like abortive medications around that time to get some control.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We are talking about migraines with Dr. Al for the UW Pain Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been able to find relief for your migraines? What has worked for you? What hasn't? How have migraines impacted your daily life, your family, your work to do the things you want to do? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about migraines, which affect about 47 million Americans, 75% of them women. Our guest is Dr. Al, Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services, Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share, maybe something that worked for you, or a question for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Heath is with us now in Oregon. Heath, hi.
Yes, I was curious that, like, I suffer from cluster headache and wondering what the treatments for cluster headaches and migraines are similar. And if, is there, because I'm just basically to oxygen and giving myself a shot in the leg for my cluster headache. Is that in comparison with a lot of migraines?
He, thanks for the question. Sorry to hear that. I understand cluster headaches are not a good time at all. Dr. Al, is there a relationship, or you want to compare and contrast cluster headaches versus migraine?
Yeah, so these are two different kinds of headache. And, you know, I'm glad actually cluster headaches happen more in men than women. So that's a great example here. And the treatment, I would say, as we mentioned here, our patient mentioned like taking oxygen. That's actually a good measure. Some of the medications can work for both. But I highly recommend, you know, to be checked, because there are things, but based on physical exam and history, we can do more in means of medications and interventions to help the cluster headache.
Heath, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brandon joins us now in Onalaska. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So I used to suffer from migraines, and 8 years ago, I had a stroke that was classified as RCVS, or reversible cerebrovascular syndrome. And it was just a constriction of the blood vessels in my brain. And ever since then, I actually have not had a migraine. So I'm just curious if you've ever heard about that, like other people who have had migraines and then possibly had a stroke or even like a brain injury and then just never had migraines after that.
Wow, Brandon, well, I'm sorry to hear about the stroke, but I guess I'm glad you had the silver lining of no migraines. What do you make of that, Dr. Al?
So I have seen this before. I wouldn't say it's common, but as we spoke earlier about the mechanism of action, a lot of it has to do with, release of chemical mediators, vasoconstriction. Having some vascular event might actually, I would say, reverse that process or cause opposite process. That's why migraines do not get triggered the same way. Reduce the excitability of the cells. So there is some science behind this, and it can happen.
Interesting. Brandon, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Now you, Dr. Al, specialize in headaches and migraines. Doesn't sound like there are a ton of specialists out there. Do we have the expertise out there that people can access and get diagnosis and treatment from?
And you make a very good point with talking about the shortage now and everything. Before even the pandemic, we had shortage in headache medicine, basically, providers. But I would say it's practiced by neurology and pain management. So I'll give an example here at UW. We have a very robust headache group in neurology who start working with the medication management. And then when it comes to the interventional part, then we do it here at the pain clinics. We have a very comprehensive setting here at UW. But you're right. Yeah, it's not common to find people who care for headache patients. But I guess we're lucky in Wisconsin.
Now, for people who have occasional migraines, they're not a super regular part of their lives. They may not need some of the more serious interventions. Are there, I guess, over-the-counter or self-treatments that can help people with that, you know, with that occasional migraine problem?
Yes. There are the abortive medication that people can use over-the-counter medication like NSAIDs, Tylenol, and all those medication. And if these control the pain, I think that's sufficient. And I would highly recommend for those patients to get established, not necessarily get any treatments, but get established at the headache clinic or the pain clinic. make sure people know you, and make sure, you know, sometimes headache can be a sign of something else going on. That's why maybe some workup will be needed to make sure there's no brain tumor, for example, because headache is not only migraine. There are many other reasons. So more kind of, you know, get it cleared, checked, be established in a system. Because if at any point the over-the-counter medications are not working, there are other medications that can be used also for aborting the headaches. So I would say I want to make sure the patient is well taken care of by the professionals.
We are talking to Dr. Alaa Abd El-Sayed, a.k.a. Dr. Al, Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services, Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic, looking at migraines. It's National Migraine and Headache Awareness Month. Still time for your calls with your experiences, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm 64 now, but I suffered from migraines for about, you know, 10, 20 years. It's just a blur, so I don't remember how many years. But I took, first of all, I took a prescription called Axert, A-X-E-R-T, and it was really great for migraines. But the best part of what I'm going to tell you is, unfortunately, I had a stroke 5 years ago. And it was one that I fully recovered from. But when I was in the hospital, when I went to the ER, they gave me TPA injection. And it's something that goes through your blood vessels and breaks up all the blood clots, I guess. And ever since I had TPA in that stroke, I've never had a headache, not even a headache or a migraine.
Wow. Okay, Elizabeth, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Al, obviously we don't want to have a stroke be our cure for our migraines, but is there something we can learn from that, though, that can help us treat migraines, you know, without going through the stroke?
You know, exactly the same observation that, you know, unfortunately, getting stroke is not great, but might help the headaches again. You know, it's kind of the whole idea here is you're trying to control the kind of the vascular tone in the brain. Obviously, by strokes, you know, that can reverse the process of migraine, so they don't trigger again because you don't get the vasoconstriction anymore. So I would say, I mean, it's probably one good thing about having a stroke, but all strokes overall are not desired.
Elizabeth, thanks again for that call. Dr. Al, you talked about that ablation treatment you pioneered some years back as something that's working for people. What else are you looking at on the horizon when it comes to research or potential treatments, maybe especially for the people who just haven't found relief from the existing options?
You know, that's another excellent question. So every time I see a patient where we don't have something at the moment to treat them, I always ask them to check back in a year. Because there is a lot of evolution happening in the management of migraine, both in medications and interventions and implantable devices. So I'm aware of now of many actually devices that will be implanted for treating migraine as well as new medications. So I highly recommend any patient out there who could not find relief for the pain for years, please keep it checking every year. There is a lot coming every year that can help managing your migraines. You don't have to be sitting up with this disabling condition, but rather get the appropriate pain relief.
So you mentioned implantable devices. Are these things going in our brains, or are they just things that release hormones? What are we talking about?
Yeah, there are implantable devices actually one of them just got the approval where you can put it actually on the outside of the head, and it does help with migraine headaches. And we have used them at UW. And then there are medications coming to work with different mechanisms of action. And there are implantable devices which will deliver medications. You put them high up in the neck. And again, the evolution keep happening. Every year we're finding more treatments for pain and migraines.
And I want to bring things around to where I started here. Where is the line between, I get headaches sometimes like people do, and, hey, I should go get this checked out with a doctor? Can you give some encouragement for who should maybe be seeking out medical help and looking a little more deeply into those headaches?
Sure. First of all, there are warning signs. If the headache is coming with warning symptoms or signs, for example, like, you know, loss of control, loss of urine control, worst headache ever, impairment in vision. So I would say something concerning. Or happening too frequent, then definitely need to be checked. Not necessarily to get treatment or diagnose migraine, but more to clear that there is nothing serious going on. Again, people need to remember that's how people find about brain tumors, about how hemorrhage is that they will get headache. That will be the first thing that will happen. So we want to make sure there is nothing dangerous going on. Then if the patient, again, happy after clearance with some over-the-counter medications, completely fine. But if it gets more frequent or getting worse or more severe, then they need to be revisit their physician to make sure they get appropriate treatment and control. One important piece of information I'd like to mention, the longer the pain and migraines go uncontrolled, the harder to treat. It's better to control it as they happen.
Well, that's a good message. Just very briefly, that's when to seek medical treatment. Are there headache symptoms that should take us to an emergency room for urgent treatment?
Yes. Again, whenever you have warning signs, symptoms or signs like I mentioned, this is definitely something that need to go immediately to be checked because it could be, you know, a symptom of some dangerous condition.
Dr. Al, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Alaa Abed El-Sayed, Medical Director of the UW Health Pain Services and Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic, where he performs migraine pain interventions. He joined us today for a look at migraines, some of their causes, their symptoms, and their treatments. Hey, if you have found something that works for you, if you have a happy ending story for a migraine condition, something that helps prevent them or treat them, let us know about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, a legal studies professor joins us to look at the separation of church and state. That's in the wake of two recent Supreme Court rulings just over the last week related to religion and public schools. One, when state governments might have to provide funding to religious schools. Another, on prayer on school grounds at public schools. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the State Department of Justice is filing a lawsuit aimed at blocking Wisconsin's 1849 law that bans almost all abortions. We'll talk with Attorney General Josh Call about the legal challenge. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was not the only big ruling to come out over the last week. The justices also released decisions in a pair of cases that set precedent on religion and public schools. First, they struck down a Maine law that prevented taxpayer dollars from funding tuition for religious schools as part of a program that helped people in rural areas without local schools pay the cost of private schools. Then the court ruled that a high school football coach could be allowed to pray on the field after games. In those cases, players and others gathered around him during the prayers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you view the separation between church and state and how it plays out, especially at issues affecting public schools? Do you support the idea of using public dollars in some cases to pay religious school tuition? Do you think school authorities, school employees should be allowed to pray on school grounds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I gave very capsule headline summaries of both those cases. Let's pick them apart a little more. Let's start with this newest ruling on a high school football coach. The court ruled that a school couldn't prevent him from doing these prayers on the 50-yard line after games. We see images of people gathered around him. Can you talk more about that case and what the Supreme Court decided?
Sure. It's really a strikingly radical change in the rules about religion in schools, but to understand why, one has to dig into it fairly closely. So for a long time, there have been two principles that governed how the Establishment Clause works in the school context. One is that children are vulnerable. So things that we might allow adults to do, the classic example is prayers at legislative sessions or prayers when a court opens up a session, those might be okay because we expect that adults who don't share the religious belief of the prayer won't feel somehow pressed or coerced to act as though they do or feel that they ought to. But historically, for at least 50 years, we've said that children, and children has been always defined to include anyone up to the end of high school, are vulnerable. If they see their teachers or their school administrators leading prayers or engaging in religious activities or promoting religion, we worry that this will the students will experience this as a kind of coercion to try and make them want to join that religion. One thing that's really striking about this opinion in Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, which is the case that you're talking about, is that that distinction is completely absent. In writing the opinion, Alito relied on cases involving adults, and particularly a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway, involving prayers at legislative sessions. And in that case, there's all kinds of discussion about how adults are different from children. That distinction simply disappeared and isn't mentioned at all. The second really striking thing here is that, as you mentioned, anyone who's followed this case at all in the news has seen these photographs of dozens of players in uniform, kneeling on the 50-yard line with a crowd around them. That's not how the court described events. The court described events as the coach taking a knee all by himself, away from the students, praying in silence. In other words, it was a blatantly, I don't know how else to say this, dishonest description of the facts and circumstances designed to create a scenario that would enable them to say that the school was suppressing this coach's exercise of his free speech and religious free exercise rights. And the third thing that's very, very striking about this case is the thing I just mentioned, the way it combines free exercise and free speech to argue that school teachers, coaches, and presumably other public officials, but specifically school teachers and school employees, have a combined right of free expression and free exercise, and that when those two rights combine, they become exceptionally strong, and that's what protects this public act of prayer by a school official during the school hours, while on duty, while around students. So all three of those points that I just mentioned are just complete departures from easily 50 years of jurisprudence in this area, and signal a very, very radical turn toward allowing, if not requiring, a much greater presence for religious expression and religious, I don't want to say indoctrination, but let's say encouraging religiosity in public school settings.
An argument is a kid isn't required to go up and kneel around the coach. Say in this instance, they could stay on the sidelines, talk to their friends, whatever. What do you make of that? I that's a response I've seen anyway. It's not coercion. It's voluntary.
Sure. So again, this is not a new issue. The most famous case of this had to do with prayers at a high school graduation. And again, for not quite 50 years, in this case, it's merely 40 years or 30 years. For 30 years, there's been a well-established proposition that say that where young people are concerned, especially school children, we're likely to find coercion in situations where we might not find it in the case of adults. And so we recognize the social pressure might be placed on students to participate in religious activity. In this case, there was more. The school district reported hearing complaints that students felt that if they didn't participate in the prayers, they wouldn't get playing time. And journalists who spoke to students heard from them directly that they felt that the coach wouldn't favor them on the field if they didn't participate in these prayer exercises. And that at least some of them said they did so unwillingly in order to remain in good graces with the coach. Confronted by this argument, the court's attitude was, well, that's only hearsay. We don't have real evidence of that, and so we're not going to consider the question. As I say, the justices in the majority really dramatically rewrote the facts to create a set of situations that would enable them to say that none of the traditional tests that have governed religion in schools should apply here, and then turned around and made a rule that arguably undercuts all those earlier rules altogether. So the question is, in a future case, if there really is evidence of coercion, let's leave aside the question of what happened here. Suppose in a future case, a coach says to prayers, you can't play unless you join my prayers. You know, what will a court do then? The way the Supreme Court handled the facts in this case, you might think it's easy to say, aha, this is different. This one has coercion and that one didn't, right? That is accepting the facts on their face as presented by the majority. The problem is that the new explanation of the rules involved governing the conduct of teachers is such that it's very unclear how the Establishment Clause would limit those activities at all. The other question is that coercion is not the only standard under the Establishment Clause. Until, well, yesterday, There's also been a rule that public endorsement of religion, that is public declarations that citizens or students in particular in schools who are members of a certain religion are more fully appreciated as citizens than those who are not, or that religious affiliation has something to do with citizenship or with the status of a student or with being a student in a school. That was separate from coercion. That was viewed as a violation of the Establishment Clause. That's simply off the table. That entire theory of endorsement has been abolished by this one decision. And even beyond that, you'll notice I'm emphasizing the radicalness of this decision, that I intend to. A case that goes back to the 1970s called Lemon versus Kurtzman, which was just a general overall framework for considering Establishment Clause questions, has also been overruled. And what's most striking is that in the opinion, the court simply says, well, we're not overruling it. We're simply assuming this case had effectively been overruled before, and we expected everyone to know that. It's a very strange opinion that way. It's very unusual, not to say unheard of, for the court to say a major precedent was overruled, even though we never said so. And you, the lower courts, and you, the public, are simply expected to have understood that at some point in the last 30 years. And we're now declaring going forward, not that we need to overrule that case, it simply isn't a precedent anymore. It is not a precedent anymore, and let's go forward from here. It's a wildly sweeping decision that goes much further than it needed to resolve this case, and does so in a way that formally announces that the Establishment Clause is dramatically weakened and has dramatically less force than it did last week.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison about two U.S. Supreme Court decisions on religion and public schools. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Mineral Point. Josh, hi.
Yes, I mean, I understand the difference between church and state and everything else, but what would we got a bunch of white Christians in the Supreme Court now. What's the difference if someone by the name of Ali put a prayer blanket down at the end of the field and started praying? Would the Supreme Court overturned it then?
Josh, thanks for the call. Howard, I know this is a question I've seen other people bring up. Would non-Christians trying to do something similar enjoy similar protections?
My assumption is yes. Now, the caveat there is the point I made earlier about, I think I misspoke, Gorsuch wrote the opinion, how he manipulated the facts. So there's always the possibility that if we have a future case with, let us say, a Muslim football coach who, as the caller says, puts down his prayer rug and prays at the 50-yard line, a court will find a way to distinguish that case on the facts somehow. But more generally, this court is perfectly happy, and these, as the caller says, white Christian justices are perfectly happy to allow religious expression in general, because they understand that in this country, the vast majority of the time, that's going to be Christian expression. In other words, it's a version of neutrality that says we will accept all religions equally, and we will pay no attention to the fact that some religions are much more majoritarian than others in our particular society, and that it is much, much more likely that a non-Christian student will be made to feel isolated by public displays of Christian worship than the opposite.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber about church and state and public schools in the wake of two new U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state tax money should be used to support religious schools in some instances? When yes, when no? Do you think school officials should be allowed to publicly hold prayers on school grounds to lead prayer circles, for example? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments or your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber, with us today looking at the legal impact of two recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings over funding religious schools and prayer at a public high school. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Howard, before we go back to our callers, let's visit Maine now, this other case that led to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on funding by the state for religious schools. What happened there?
So this is a case that follows up on a series of previous cases over the last few years dealing with the question of when a state or whether a state may provide funding for some private school activities and not others. Specifically, Maine had a law that said that in rural areas where there was a lack of access to public schools. State funds could be used for parents to send children to private schools. The law had a restriction that said those funds could not be used to send children to religious private schools. Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, said that this is a discrimination against religion. Maine argued that it was not, and that the difference was that the secular private schools offered the same education as the public schools, whereas religious private schools were offering something different, and that was a fair basis for distinction. But Roberts rejected that argument. He said to distinguish between religious private schools and secular private schools is simply discrimination against religion and is impermissible. Therefore, if Maine, and by extension any other state, wants to provide funding for use in any private schools, it must allow those funds to be used in religious private schools. And if I can go back to a point the caller made on the previous case, that will apply equally to Christian schools and Muslim schools and Jewish schools and any other school that is recognized as a religious private school.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Conrad is with us in Platteville. Conrad, hi.
Yeah, I think schools pass state education standards that people's money that they supposedly contribute to the state for education of their own children or their grandchildren or whoever's children should be able to go to any school in that state that meets those standards.
Conrad, thanks a lot for that call. So, Howard, I believe Maine had tried to set a standard that that those schools couldn't include a religious indoctrination. I don't know if that's the word they use, but religious instruction. So this ruling would seem to say, no, a state can't set that standard.
That's correct. So, I mean, your caller's point is certainly well taken. As long as the school is providing an education, who cares who is providing the education? The answer is, at least in the past, we used to care about what else the school might be doing. So you can go all the way back to the writings of James Madison, when even before the Constitution even, when he wrote his famous essay in Virginia. And he said, it is a crime against conscience to ask someone to contribute tax dollars to be used to promulgate and promote a faith that he doesn't believe in. The problem is not that the religious schools in question are not providing education. The argument was they're also doing something else, which is proselytizing a religion. And public funds shouldn't be used for that purpose, because one person's money shouldn't be used, in this Madisonian notion, to promote a faith in which they do not believe. The Roberts Court has now rejected that principle and said that the fact that these schools may be engaged in promoting faith and proselytizing or anything else doesn't matter. Those are separate from the fact that they function as schools. In a way, the Roberts Court is taking the same view as our caller. It says as long as they're providing an education, the state has no good basis for excluding them based on what else they might be doing.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at two U.S. Supreme Court cases on religion and public schools with Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned that the first case we talked about prayer on the football field there, very wide in scope, that ruling with this main school funding one. Do you see this as having a wide scope that's going to affect a lot of other, for example, state school funding laws?
Oh, absolutely. And the two cases go together. So the football coach prayer case weakens the Establishment Clause in the sense it drastically reduces the restrictions that the Establishment Clause places on what is acceptable behavior by public teachers and other public officials. The main case, it's called Carson versus Macon, weakens a different Establishment Clause principle, which is one that would have until now prohibited using public money for the direct teaching of religion to children, or at least permitted states to refuse to use money to be used that way. What the two cases have in common is they both dramatically weaken the Establishment Clause. And when I say that, I mean in comparison to what it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. The Establishment Clause, like all constitutional provisions, undergoes evolution over time, and the doctrines have shifted over time. But for at least 50 years, we have said that the use of public money to promulgate religion directly, and particularly to do so in schools, is a line that should not be crossed and is prohibited by the Establishment Clause. This is the latest in a series of cases. There were others in the last couple of 3 years that have removed that restriction and caused the Establishment Clause to become that much weaker. At the same time, the treatment of the football coach emphasizes how much the free exercise clause has been strengthened and has been connected to the free speech clause. So the whole balance, right? Separation of church and state is a slogan, In practice, it's always a matter of striking a balance between public roles and government actions and religious authorities and churches. And that balance has shifted pretty dramatically in the last 3 days, like 3 or 4 days.
Let's go back to our callers now. Pam is with us in Bagley. Pam, hello.
Hi, I am interested in both of the cases and wondering what happens. It seems like it's a slippery slope. Wonder what happens when we have a teacher or a coach who's identifying as a Satanist and wants to bring that religion into the football field or into the classroom. And can we support dollars going to a Satanist?
Pam, thanks for the call. And go ahead, Howard. Yeah.
Sorry. The short answer is yes, we will have to. It is not permissible to have a principle like this and apply it only to some religion. In fact, there's already been an instance, I cannot recall where, but of Satanists organizing to hold events on football fields in response to this, not the Supreme Court case, but after this controversy arose. Absolutely, we will have to allow Satanists or any other religion that one can name or make up to partake of the same freedom. And this has always been the problem. It's really important, though, I think, to remember that the reason for the Establishment Clause and the separation of church and state and all this rhetoric, all this way of thinking about the idea that we ought to keep religion out of politics has to do with the fear of majoritarian tyranny. Again, going all the way back to James Madison, the concern was that the majority religion would use its ability to become influential over public affairs to impose its agenda and to oppress or suppress members of minority religions. And so, you know, the danger of Satanists holding prayers on a football field is that it might be shocking or perhaps offensive. The argument is, or the argument was until this week, that the danger of having Christian prayers on a football field is different. It has the capacity to make everyone feel that if they're not Christian, they're not part of the mainstream society and not fully members of the community. That's not really a risk with prayers being conducted by Satanists. But that whole concern about majoritarian domination that was at the heart of the creation of the Establishment Clause at the founding has essentially been written out of that clause by the Roberts Court.
Thanks for that call, Pam. We'll go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I was a little confused when I read the main decision. Well, when I heard about it, it seemed like the money was going right to the school. But when I read the decision, it looks like it goes to the parents, and then the parents made the decision to send the kid to parochial school. And I don't know if there's other options for the parents or if that was the only school they had.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Does it matter if it's a voucher type thing like that, Howard, where state money goes to a parent and then they make the decision on a religious school?
The answer is it does. And that's not new. That goes back to the early 2000s. The term is intervening private choice. So the idea is, maybe we're concerned about the state giving money directly to religious schools, but that concern is obviated. If the money goes to parents, then parents make a private choice about what schools to attend. The criticisms of that theory are that very often the only religious schools that are eligible for the funds are Christian schools and usually Catholic schools, because of support for those schools from the Catholic establishment, which is not, there is no equivalent establishment for Muslim or Protestant or Jewish or Hindu schools to fund their existence. The other question is, and I think the caller nailed it really when he said, you know, what if there's no other alternative? And that's exactly right. That is, if a religious school opens in an area where, and remember, this was a program directed at rural education, in a rural area where the nearest alternative is far, so that it's at least much easier to go to the religious school, then you have a draw, a reason that would encourage parents who might not even share that necessarily that faith to send their students to that school. The problem with all of these arguments, such as the intervening private choice, there are two problems, excuse me. One is it's a formalistic argument. It's like the old joke, if the missiles go up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, as a line from a song once said. If we know where the money is going, the fact that we funnel it through parents, does that obviate the concerns that led to the creation of the Establishment Clause in the first place? And the second problem is that if there is a lack of other alternatives, then this becomes effectively something that looks a little bit coercive. And for both of those reasons, traditionally, prior to very recent times, these laws would have been upheld.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at separation of church and state after two Supreme Court rulings related to religious issues and public schools around the country. Last week, I talked about the winner of the Westminster Dog Show, the first ever bloodhound to win the award. Now, here's another prestigious prize in the dog world from over the last week. The winner of the world's ugliest dog competition announced last Friday in Petaluma, California. It's Mr. Happy Face. Mr. Happy Face is a 17-year-old hairless Chinese crested Chihuahua mix. I've looked at some pictures. He is a distinctive-looking dog. He was adopted as a rescue dog later in life. As reported in USA Today, his human companion says, "When I first met him, he was the happiest creature that I'd ever met. He hobbled up to me and chose me." Well, congratulations to Mr. Happy Face. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. This is Central Time.